All right, friends, we're going to try something a little crazy this morning. We're going to try to look at two of Jesus' seven signs at the same time. Now, crazy might be a bit of an overstatement. But then again, we have spent 2 months now meticulously working our way through the Gospel of John, the first half of it at least, which is often referred to again as the Book of Signs. Book of Signs because these 11 and a half, 12 chapters here focus on seven signs or miracles that Jesus performed in order to reveal himself to be the Messiah. Now, over the last 2 months, we have looked at three of the seven signs. Sign one, turning water to wine. Sign two, healing a sick child from a distance. And sign three, healing a paralyzed man at a pool. Today, though, we're going to try to tackle signs four and five together. You may wonder why we would do that, given that we've been so careful in getting here, and more importantly, given that John is so careful to feature these seven signs. Like, why would we try to tackle two at once? Like, shouldn't we give each sign its due? Well, the answer is yes, we should, and we will. But it's just that signs four and five actually work together to reveal something really significant about Jesus. Via a very public miracle that's followed quickly by a very private miracle, Jesus reveals himself to be greater than Moses. Now, that may not seem like that big of a deal to us, but to the Jewish people to whom Jesus shared these signs with, this was a big honking deal. Not only is Jesus the man whom God used to lead Jesus or to lead the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt, not only is he the person through whom God gave his law to the world, God specifically promised the people of Israel and the world that he would send someone else like Moses in the end. Well, by way of two signs in John 6, Jesus says, more or less, that is me. If you want to join me in John 6, which begins on page 1623 in the Bibles under your seats, you're going to find two signs which you may find to be familiar. That's why I feel like we can tackle these two at once. Now, that said, there is a lot to unpack here, so we have some work in front of us, but I pray that God would give us eyes to see and ears to hear what these two signs have to say about our lives and about the world that God sent Jesus to save. So join me. Let's read John 6, 1 through 24. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the signs he had performed by healing the sick. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover festival was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already knew, had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "It would take more than a half a year's wages to buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "Here is a boy with five small barley loaves and two small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and they sat down. About 5,000 men were there. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the five barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who has come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew to the mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into the boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were frightened. But Jesus said to them, "It is I, don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat. And immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. The next day, the crowd that had stayed on the opposite shore of the lake realized that only one boat had been there and that Jesus had not entered it with his disciples, but they had gone away with alone. Then some boats from Tiberias landed near the place where the people had eaten the bread after the Lord had given thanks. Once the crowd realized that neither Jesus nor his disciples were there, they got into boats and went to Capernaum in search of Jesus. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, so how many of you are familiar with at least one of those miracles? Maybe both, right? Many of you. Okay, that's what I thought, right? I mean, these are well-known miracles. I mean, first of all, walking on water is something that's even made its way into popular culture. It's an expression that people sometimes use for talking about doing things that seem to be impossible, like that dude walks on water. As for feeding the 5,000, it's actually one of only two of the miracles of Jesus that actually show up in all four Gospels. Do you know what the other miracle is? The resurrection of Jesus. Kind of a big deal, right? Well, this one might be a big deal as well. The thing is about when it comes to this miracle is some say that we should probably refer to this as the feeding of the 15,000. That's because John says that there were 5,000 men there. You know, we can assume that some of these men had wives and some of these couples had kids. And so scholars say that 15,000 would be a better estimate of how many people are actually there. But however many people are actually there, it would seem that it is way more than Jesus and his disciples could feed. And I use the word seem intentionally there because John tells us that Jesus intended to test his disciples. Namely, Philip, whom he asks, hey, where can we buy enough bread to feed all these people? Like, is there a Panera nearby? Philip doesn't pass Jesus' test, but he doesn't fail it either. I mean, he's like, look, it would take more than half a year's wages just for everyone to have a bite. And notice that that's just to have a bite. That's not for everyone to get their fill. Well, Philip is not wrong in his calculations. It's just that he also has no idea what Jesus is about to do. No one has any idea what he's about to do. It's why the other gospel writers of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, when they recount this story, they specifically say that the disciples of Jesus try to tell Jesus what to do. You know, this newly formed board of directors, advisors, tell Jesus that he should send people away. And Jesus says, nope, we're going to have them sit down and we're actually going to feed them. Now, one of the other disciples, Andrew, says, well, look, I found this kid who's got, you know, two fish and two loaves of bread, but that's not enough to feed everyone. So, you know, Andrew is also not wrong in his calculations. Even if this were like, you know, two king salmon and two like party-sized subs, still not enough, right? Which is actually what makes this miracle so significant. Jesus starts breaking bread and fish, and he starts handing it to disciples who start handing it to people. And the supply chain doesn't stop until everyone has had enough to eat. Now, this was probably a rare occurrence in most people's lives. I mean, people may have gotten their fill at the annual Jewish feasts, maybe on the occasional Sabbath, but this is everyone on this hill getting their fill, like every man, woman, and child. And on top of that, there are 12 baskets of leftovers. I don't miss the Easter egg here, right? 12 baskets of leftovers, 12 tribes of Israel. Well, the people of Israel don't miss this. In fact, verse 14 says that after the people saw the sign Jesus performed, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world. Now, the prophet, that would be like the capital P prophet, would be a reference to the promise that I mentioned a moment ago. That would be the one where God said he would send someone like or perhaps greater than Moses in the end. You'll find this in Deuteronomy 18. Well, via sign number 4, Jesus says, that's me. Now that said, you may wonder, well, did this actually happen? That's a question that a lot of people have asked, and it's an answer that, you know, this question that some people try to explain away. In fact, a commentator named J. Vernon McGee talks about something that happened when he was in college, and he said his professor just dismissed this thing as a completely irrelevant thing. He says that this little thing was nothing more than a sleight of hand trick that you might see a magician or street performer do. Because what really happened is Jesus' disciples, they gathered all this fish and all this bread in advance, and they hid it in a cave, which Jesus stood in front of, and his disciples were behind him, passing it to him under his arms, which were, of course, hidden by his long flowing robe. Yeah, you giggle, right? I mean, it's possible, but like, doesn't it seem like it would take way more faith to believe that than perhaps what actually happened? That here is another example of God providing food for people in need. You know, kind of like he did with Israel when Israel was in the desert after its exodus from Egypt. Of course, if you think that sign's hard to fathom, wait till you see what happens next, right? So after that sign number four, which happened somewhere on the far side of the Sea of Galilee, that would be on the east side. And so, you know, it's called the Sea of Galilee. Sometimes it's called a lake. You may have noticed that in this passage. Jesus did this somewhere on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. After doing that, Jesus withdraws to be alone, to get away from the crowd. And it would seem the disciples are pretty familiar with Jesus doing this, because when it gets to be night, they're not like, where is Jesus? They just take off to head back to Capernaum on the west side of the lake. I guess they figured that Jesus, you know, he would take the scenic route home, like he would walk all the way around. Thing is about the Sea of Galilee is storms regularly pop up here without warning. It's something to do with the geography of the region, and that seems to be what happens here. Like verse 18 says that a strong wind was blowing and the waters grew rough. Verse 19 says that the disciples, when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles out into the middle of the sea or the lake, they saw Jesus approaching them, walking on the water, and they were frightened. Who can blame them, right? But verse 20 says, but Jesus said, "It is I. Don't be afraid." Which is a little bit of a less than stellar translation, in my opinion, because I actually think Jesus says something more significant than that. I think verse 20 literally says, Jesus said to them, "I am. Don't be afraid." Now, that's a weird thing to say until you remember that that's actually what God said to Moses right before he sent him to lead the people of Israel out of slavery in Egypt. So in Exodus chapter 3, God appears to Moses in the form of a burning bush, which Moses is afraid of. Who can blame him, right? But God speaks to Moses from out of the bush. He comforts him, and then he commands him to go to Egypt and to lead Israel to its freedom. Moses asks, well, who should I say sent me to do this? And God says, I am. And from that point on, the people of Israel understood I am, that is Yahweh, to be God's name. The thing is, the name Yahweh, which I think we have a slide for, is the name that Israel identified with God, but it is a name that they would never utter. The people of Israel would never utter these words out of fear of maybe accidentally taking God's name in vain. Which is actually why it's so shocking that Jesus says, I am, so many times in the Gospel of John. Jesus says, I am, at least 7 times in the Gospel of John. Here's a list of the major times that he says it. 7 times, which, you know, kind of pairs interestingly with the fact that John features 7 signs in his Gospel. Do you think John is trying to tell us something about Jesus? Now, full disclosure, you should know that whenever Jesus says, I am, the word that he uses is not the Hebrew word or the Hebrew name, Yahweh. It's actually the Greek equivalent, ego eimi. The reason Jesus used those words, or at least those are the words that are recorded, is the Gospel of John, along with the rest of the New Testament, was written in Greek, not in Hebrew. And truth be told, first century Jews, including Jesus, actually spoke a different language than that. They spoke Aramaic, which was kind of like a sister language to Hebrew. Now, I don't mean to give you like a language lesson or to belabor the point. I just want to be upfront about the fact that Jesus uses a different word than the one that God uses in Exodus 3. Oh, but Jesus means exactly what God meant in Genesis 3. And everyone understood what Jesus meant. Like, if you don't believe me, believe the Pharisees. Like, we'll see when we get to John chapter 8, they are literally ready to stone Jesus to death for the sin of blasphemy. That's because they say, you are claiming to be God. You are taking God's name by declaring yourself to be God. And they're doing so for him saying the name, the words, I am. Now, we'll unpack that story, that scene, in full when we get to John 8 in a couple of weeks. But even here in John 6, we get a preview of what's to come. Because it seems that the disciples have some sense as to what Jesus is saying when he says, I am. Now, that's why they're willing to take him into the boat. And when they do, John says that immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. Now, scholars are all over the place about what happens here. Like, some say this is another miracle. Some say that, you know, that's John is just saying that, you know, the boat reached the shore without further delay from the storm. Some say that, you know, maybe it just didn't seem like the shore was so far away because they were so relieved to have Jesus in the boat. I don't really know what happens. What I do know is people have a knack for trying to explain this miracle away as well. Case in point, J. Vernon McGee's professor in college. He has a theory for this miracle as well. He says what actually happened here is Jesus was walking along the shore, and the disciples just thought that he was walking on the water, and that Jesus just happened to time it nicely, that he happened to step into the boat right about the time their boat reached the shore. Now, again, it's possible, right? But it also feels like it takes more faith to believe that than perhaps what actually happened. I mean, first of all, many of Jesus' disciples are fishermen who fished on this very sea for a living. It seems unlikely they're going to make a mistake like that. Beyond that, Jesus has incredible timing. He also is incredibly fast because he managed to run all the way around the sea before his disciples could sail across it. I think it's more likely the case that Jesus did what John reports, and by the way, which also Matthew and Luke report as well. Of course, what these three gospel writers report is admittedly hard to believe, but maybe that's actually the point. What if Jesus is actually revealing something significant about himself? What if he's telling us that he is like Moses, but perhaps he's also greater than Moses? And this wouldn't be a new thing in John's gospel. John says earlier, at the beginning of his gospel, out of Jesus' fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. And when John says that, he's not dissing Moses. I think he's just previewing what Jesus actually demonstrates in today's passage. Moses was significant. He led Israel's exodus out of Egypt, which required crossing the Red Sea, which God parted for Moses and the people of Israel. Well, don't miss the fact that Jesus crosses this sea by walking on top of it. Jesus demonstrates his power over chaos. And I say that because in the Jewish mind, in Hebrew culture, the sea was a symbol of chaos. It represented the chaos of the world. Jesus demonstrates his power over chaos, which in a way begins to reveal himself as God. And I say that not only because of the connection to Genesis 1, where the Spirit of God is seen hovering over the chaotic waters of creation. Job 9 flat out says that God alone stretches out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. What makes Jesus greater than Moses is the fact that Jesus is God. Jesus both shows and tells his disciples this via sign number 5. He also showed this to the masses via sign number 4. And so you know, he will also tell this to the masses in the second half of John 6, which we'll look at next week. Please be here for next week. Our friend Travis Fletcher is going to unpack some remarkable things that Jesus teaches in the back half of the Gospel of John. There is so much in there. But this week, as we wrap things up, I just want to observe a few things, some significant things that Jesus reveals about himself as God in this story. Don't overlook the fact that Jesus doesn't send anyone away. He actually feeds everyone. That's because God doesn't turn away those who seek him. In fact, he answers our prayers for daily bread. At the same time, notice that Jesus provides enough for everyone and then some. In other words, God isn't stingy with his provision because he doesn't have to be stingy. Jesus is the Lord of creation. Like, he owns everything, and therefore he can share everything freely. By the way, he actually frees us to do the same. Of course, perhaps most importantly, because Jesus provides for us and he is with us, we don't have to be afraid. We can trust him in and through the storms of life. Now, that doesn't mean that we get a pass from life storms. It just means that we have someone with us in the storm. That is, if we choose to let him into the boat of our lives. If we don't, we might experience something of the grace of God, but we will never know it in full. We will be like the people here in John 6, the masses who follow Jesus from one side of the sea to the other and then back again because, you know, he's performing miracles and providing lunch. I mean, these people welcome the gifts of God, but I fear that many of them miss out on the very presence of God that is right in front of them. And the thing that Scripture makes clear again and again is that life, eternal life, abundant life, whatever you want to call it, is not found in the gifts of God. It's actually found in the presence of God himself. True life actually is found in living life with God, not from God or for God or under God or over God. So you know that little like running off of prepositions relates to a thesis of a book by a guy named Sky Jathani. He wrote a book a few years ago called With, Reimagining the Way You Relate to God. And in this book, Sky Jathani talks about the very things that we're talking about, this idea that we would actually live our lives with God, not in distorted ways that maybe keep us from experiencing the fullness of God's presence. And Jathani gives us examples of the ways that people talk about their faith that maybe gives us a glimpse into the ways that people live out their lives, perhaps the way that we do these things. You know, he says there's the businessman who expects God to bless his business because he goes to church, regardless of how he runs his business or how he lives his life. That would be an example of life from God. There's the medical student who's struggling with her career path because she believes that she has to go into quote-unquote ministry if she's truly going to make a difference in the world and honor God with her career. That's life for God. There's the church leader who has this great vision for the church and who has great leadership skills but who rarely prays and seems to have no communion with God. That's life over God. There's the mother who can't figure out why her son is struggling with his mental health. He's wrestling with depression. How could this be when, you know, we raised him according to the Bible? That's life under God. Jathani gives all sorts of examples of things that if you're paying attention, we may find ourselves hearing these things and maybe saying these things. You know, I don't really think about God much, you know, when I'm at work or in my everyday life. That's life over God. If we can just stop those liberal judges, God will bless our country again. That's life under God. Every morning I wake up and ask God to expand my territory, and he has. Hashtag blessed. That's life from God. You know, I feel like I got to change some things in my life. I'm just not doing enough for God. I know God expects me to do more. That's life for God. These are examples of things that people say. But what Jesus says is, sit with me. Eat with me. Walk with me. Listen to me. Abide in me. So, you know, that's the end. That's the thesis of Sky Jethani's books. If you want to read it, you're welcome to purchase a copy or to borrow my copy. I just told you how it ends. But actually, it ends with this call, not just to try to figure out how to do this. It actually ends with a call to some ways that we might actually commune with God and live life with him. And the thing is the stuff that Jethani talks about is nothing new. In fact, these are the traditional practices of the Jewish people in ancient Israel and of the early church. They're actually the practices that you find central to the season of Lent, the season that we've entered into, where we think about prayer and fasting and calls to service and giving. You know, it's these practices like this that we actually begin to pay attention to God. For example, this practice of fasting, which is not a fun one, even though I'll go ahead and tell you, you have already done this. You gave up an hour of sleep last night, right? But more to the point, there is an intentional calling to give up something good, to perhaps give up things that are the very gifts of God, whether that is food, something that you like, or maybe a meal or meals, or things like technology. And the idea behind this practice, both in the season of Lent and throughout Christian tradition, is not that we would somehow suffer for God to prove ourselves to God. It's that we might actually pay attention to God and commune with God. And the purpose is to say, you know what? Whenever your stomach growls, or you're tempted to get back on TikTok, or to buy that overpriced cup of coffee, you use that as a prompt for prayer. In that moment, you thank God for every bit of his provision. You ask God to provide, continue providing for you and for the needs of others. And you actually consider the ways that God might call people like us, perhaps even you, to help provide for the needs of others who are in need. You use this as a prompt for prayer, to pray for the needs of the world, which there are many right now. To ask God to reign over the chaos in our world, to forgive us for our sins and actually to deliver us from evil. And so, you know, Lent isn't in the Bible. By the way, Sky Jethani's book is not the Bible. These are simply tools from the ancient world and the modern world to help us think about the calling of the Christian life, to help us consider the invitation of the way of life that Jesus invites us into, the way of life that he actually opened up for us by way of his life, death, and resurrection. To believe that God actually invites us to seek him, to know him, to trust him, to be with him. Friends, this is the invitation in this season and in the next, to consider the words of Jesus, to trust in his provision and his presence, and therefore not to be afraid. Thanks be to God.